the coolest thing that I've seen is when the conversation goes somewhere I didn't expect, because a student does have a personal connection, right? I have a, you know, cultural connection. Students have brought up past, you know, their ancestors or familial lines and how it relates to it. So sometimes what you get out of it is so much more, just because I wasn't even on that same page. And now, wow, that student brought this to my attention. Yes, that does connect. So it's exciting when that does happen. And you don't have that opportunity if you don't let the students really process and speak on their behalf.
Hello, welcome to Making School Matter, where we dive into the science of teaching and learning and how it is transforming education. As more teachers and school leaders discover the power of understanding how learners make meaning and how creating the right environment can help them thrive, the more this informs our everyday practices. On this show, I sit down with educators and school leaders who are bringing brain science to life in their schools and classrooms, using practical strategies to make learning more engaging, responsive, and making school matter for every student. Today, I'm joined by Liz Nessbaum, upper school history teacher who promotes active engagement, self-directed research, and collaborative learning, creating agency and autonomy among learners in her classroom. Liz, thank you for joining me today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. Can you start by just sharing a bit about yourself and what brought you to Detroit Country Day School?
Yeah, absolutely. So I didn't actually think I was going to have a career in education going into college. I dual majored in international relations and global studies. And even though I loved history, I just really was interested in current events and how the history impacts the present. More envisioning doing like a research path myself. But after moving to Michigan, I got into coaching, and that's why I really fell in love with working with high schoolers, right? Just being able to make those connections for them was so exciting, either on the field, in the classroom. I went back, got my master's in education from U of M. And then I was looking at opportunities. Detroit Country Day is such a good fit. Just the flexibility that this school gives teachers to be able to teach what content they want to teach. It allows me not just hit the kind of surface level survey that you often see in a history class, but really go in depth on topics that students are interested in, and provide them support to really explore interests and kind of pursue their own passion. So this was such a great fit of a school, and I'm very happy to be here.
We're grateful to have you here. So there's this old story of school and teaching history where the teacher stands in front of the class and delivers direct instruction, often using textbooks or slides to outload in key events, dates, important figures, etc. And the students are expected to take notes, and the teacher occasionally pauses to ask recall questions. And success in a class like this is usually measured by the accuracy of how well students can remember and reproduce the information presented. So there's nothing wrong with providing direct instruction and students having like a chronological understanding of causes and effects of historical events. But I know that you have a different culture and measure of success in your classroom. So can you share a bit about how you are rewriting a new story of being a historian and researcher in your upper school classroom?
Yeah, absolutely. So first, just addressing like that old story you're talking about, that comes about because it's easy and it's comfortable. You have full control of your classroom. You have full control of the content and every conversation that happens. So it is a hard thing to not fall into the habit of just direct instruction. Honestly, I wouldn't really say I'm rewriting being a historian here, because I think that Country Day history teachers and just teachers in general here do such a good job of not having that kind of sage on the stage mentality. We really are trying to push student-driven classrooms. And I think that's what really makes it different in my classroom, right? I'm trying to release that control, or at least some of that comfort, in lieu of having students drive their own success. It's something that's uncomfortable. You saw one of my classroom discussions, and you have to be okay with where they're at, right? You're not always going to get exactly what you envision out of it. But in the process, they discover so much more, and they get so much more out of it, right? So that's really my measure for success, is if they've demonstrated their own ownership, if they've been able to demonstrate that they have, you know, engaged with the text, or that they understand the context of an event, not necessarily can you recall a date or can you remember what was on slide 72 or whatever.
Right. It's important to, I think, understand the context of the cultural or political context of the date and why that's important. But I think what I've observed in the numerous times I've been in your classroom is that agentic learning in the classroom, right? You're there as an advocate, the lead learner, asking those probing questions or guiding learners into like, hey, have you considered this concept or something like that? And finding ways to ask those questions that make learners think about that historical context or think about personal connections, and how they can relate to some of those points in history.
Absolutely. And I think that helps them see the bigger picture, right? I think sometimes students get very caught up in like the little nitty gritty details and struggle to relate it to, like you said, their personal experiences, the cultural dynamic in our country, political dynamics in our country as a whole. So it allows them to get that more broad perspective of whatever we're discussing.
And the couple of times I've visited your classroom has been more of a discussion-based class where there's a concept or, you know, there's a shared reading, and this is kind of, you know, the way to unpack and kind of think about those things, labeled it as a Harkness discussion, right? So in Harkness discussions, usually students take the lead, sitting beside one another, exchanging ideas, and building understanding through conversation. It's a model that shifts the focus from a teacher-led instruction to more of a student-driven exploration. Liz, you use this approach in your classroom often. So can you talk us through what that actually looks like in practice?
Yeah. First, I want to say, like, people think, oh, the teacher's not doing anything. And that is so untrue. It's so much work prepping students and getting the material together in advance, right? So if you just kind of throw students in there and say, okay, we're going to switch to a discussion, and you haven't, you know, set them up, set yourself up, provided text, and it is going to collapse real quickly. So a lot of it is just the setup on my end, making sure that the text makes sense. In the case of one of the lessons you saw recently, it was provided to us by a College Board, but either way, like, kind of connecting it to some things we've already discussed in the curriculum. And then it's just really getting them comfortable with it, right? So practicing it is a skill in its own. Allowing students to understand, like, what makes a good discussion, bad discussion, that also should be student-driven, right? Because it's a little bit different class by class. But giving them opportunities to evaluate their own work, giving opportunities for students to understand what went well, what went poorly, and that sort of thing.
Well, that brings up an interesting concept that I'd like to explore a bit, the student-driven assessment. Mm-hmm. Is that something you create or co-create rubrics with the classes in how the discussions are graded, or how does that come about?
I haven't had a rubric created. And that's actually a really good answer, maybe I will. I've used previous Harkness rubrics, and I kind of switch them up so that way there's some variety, because once again, there's no like perfect way to have a conversation. If they do a rubric, which is not every single time, there's also write-in spaces and opportunities for them to add notes and that sort of thing. And usually it's more of not just checking a box, but saying, where did I fit into this picture? Other types of assessment that they do, and you saw that they're very excited about getting the role of being the person who draws the chart or is the scribe or something like that. So like letting them eventually, by this point, now we're in semester two, assess themselves a bit more. I don't have to do that as much, which I actually do like doing the chart, so it's kind of sad for me, but they get really excited about the opportunity to provide their own feedback to their fellow students, which is awesome to see.
So for those of us who want to know more about Harkness, talk to us about these charts. What are the charts about?
Yeah, so this is one of the most like kind of textbook ways you see Harkness being done. Essentially, you just draw a circle or a square, whatever you want to do, and you put everyone's name around it where they're sitting in the room. And then you are basically tracking their conversation by drawing lines either to the middle if they're kind of addressing the group, or to individual students if they use their names. And then you can really track anything you want, right? So it's super open-ended. Sometimes I just track if they're using the reading and the evidence and things of that nature, or they just set a certain page. Oftentimes I'll track if they actually use a student's name versus just say you, which is so easy to do. If they make personal connections, there's a lot of ways you can do it. Sometimes I just track if they're making eye contact. So it really is open-ended and allows you to have the flexibility to focus in on one aspect, because you can't focus in on all of it. And my students will usually pick one or two things, like I decided to focus on this. And then sometimes things shift and you just decide kind of later on, I'm going to add this in. So one conversation, I started recording the phrase, I think, because I noticed they started saying that. And I recorded over 40 times in 11 minutes. Students started saying, I think, before they said anything. So it gives you opportunity in the moment to write things down in a way that's meaningful, so you can bring it back to the students and say, hey, why did this happen? Why did we start raising hands all of a sudden? Or why did only this side of the room speak? It's a really clear way to visually show the students what I saw so they can evaluate their own work.
Yeah, and having a visual representation of a conversation like that just brings so much more meaning to how we interact with one another, how we're inviting other people into the conversation. And, you know, you had said that it takes a lot of work to get a discussion like this to become successful. It's not only the responsibility for the teacher to set the parameters of this conversation, but it's also the responsibility of the students to actively engage in a conversation like this. And I know that there's a lot of groundwork that needs to be laid to do this. How do you introduce your students to this discussion-based approach? And what are some of the strategies that you feel that help them feel comfortable taking ownership of a conversation?
Yeah, I mean, this is still a process for me figuring it out, so I don't have all the answers. The first thing I thought about was, what did I hate in a discussion? And I hated when there was one of those like situations where a teacher said, you need to speak X number of times or you're going to get a bad grade kind of thing, right? So initially, I start with very low stakes situations. Their first discussion that my seminar class had, for example, is whether or not we should colonize Mars. Something not even remotely connected to the content, although they actually did make some connections to some of our political topics, but something that no one had an advantage over someone over. No one had this like, oh, I'm this expert on Mars. At least I had not seen that. So maybe there'll be one student one day, but it gives them an opportunity where they don't feel like I have a disadvantage. They don't feel like if I don't speak, that I'm going to be punished for it. And that really helps them start feeling comfortable with the idea, right? I think also just how you do the reflection, right? It's never like you guys did a bad job or you guys did a good job. I always start with them reflecting first, right? Getting their impressions. So they're not just waiting to, okay, what's Ms. Nussbaum going to say about how this conversation went? I always say, what do you guys think? And usually they hit almost all of my points. So that way I barely even have to come in and, you know, be the person to say, oh, this is something to work on. Usually they identify themselves. That it's something to work on. I think it's also just a fact that like I will never have a discussion without a post-reflection, even if it's like 30 seconds left before class ends because they got really excited and it took a while. There always needs to be that point where we say, how did this go today? If you drop that, then the discussion really has no like anchoring and meaning, and then they get out of practice. I even noticed, we had a couple weeks where we were doing a project. We go back to Harkness and we had to relearn some things. They stopped doing some of the things that we got really good at. So I think it's just like the more they practice, the more comfortable they are, the more that they reflect, the more that they understand, you know, where the conversation needs to go. And I, even when it is graded, for the most part, I would say like 90% of the time, the grade is something that they grade themselves on. So I give them a rubric out of 12 points or something. And they are usually pretty honest in how they evaluate themselves. And that's honestly been great feedback for myself when I see a student say, I worked really hard, I really paid attention, I did all my work, but today I just really wasn't feeling comfortable. Oh, okay, that makes sense. I understand that versus, you know, why is that kid sitting there not doing anything?
As you were talking about having the opportunity to have these Harkness conversations and then diving into content a bit more and then coming back to Harkness and students having to relearn some of these skills, took me back to the mind, brain, and education strategy interleaving, where we're not only interleaving the content, but you're also interleaving the skill development. And I think that that's an important thing to think about too, that Harkness is a skill. Having a conversation with somebody is a skill, and we put content in to help us with communication, but really it's the skill of being able to analyze, being able to communicate, being able to invite somebody in, make those personal text connections. And it's important to think about not only the idea of us have better understanding of the content, but also have opportunities in the classroom to develop those conversational skills.
Absolutely. And I think that this is something the students really want to. I get really positive feedback for this style. But on top of that, they're also looking for other ways of figuring out how they can best engage in like civil discourse. We have a club kind of going on right now that we're starting up where we're giving an opportunity for students to come in and during a lunch period and to have a civil conversation about maybe an intense topic. So this is something the students are really engaging with and really seeking more of, like, how do we practice a skill? I think, you know, the students really see how poorly oftentimes the leaders and adults of the world are at communicating. So they see something like this as a real opportunity for them to work on those skills. So it's been really cool to see that they really embrace this type of learning.
Are you the faculty advisor for this club?
Yes, I'm one of the people that have been working on it. Okay. Mr. Corrigan kind of started this up in the fall as a way for students to handle some of these intense political topics as we are going into the election cycle. And it's developed since then where we've had students from different affinity groups step up as leaders. They come, and actually we're meeting today after this podcast during lunch to discuss kind of the next steps. But they became and they made their own rules and they've decided how they want to run this meeting. And the idea is that there's going to be a opportunity for students to sign up, 10 to 12 students, keeping it small, to come to lunch. We'll have a topic for the day. We've done a trial and it worked really well. But just another way for students to not just have these like discussions and turn that into an opportunity for them to get their feelings out, have a, you know, a grow in empathy for other perspectives and really engage with it rather than just kind of getting this perspective of I'm right, you're wrong, and that's it.
Have you noticed that students are using some of those skills that they're developing in your history or seminar class through Harkness? They're using it in this setting as well?
Absolutely. I have several kids overlapping between one and the other, and they bring up the class frequently and other teachers who are doing similar things and saying how it has allowed them to actually engage with someone with different beliefs rather than get that kind of emotional response and just kind of shut the other person down.
That's awesome. So this is something that's happening outside of the classroom.
Yes.
But I've also have been fortunate to be your thought partner and visit your classroom throughout the year and learn more about the ways that you engage learners. And the first time I visited your AP seminar class, you facilitated a Harkness discussion around the themes of memorialization and cultural representation using a mentor text that you had mentioned previously about the queen of Tejano music, mm-hmm. Selena. Would you please share about the context of this discussion and where it fits within the scope and sequence of the unit?
Yeah. So what's really cool about AP seminar is it's not as high stakes as maybe the other APs in terms of what happens in May, right? Usually you learn a bunch of material throughout the school year, and then May 15th, whatever, you sit down, you take a 2-hour exam, and that's 100% of your grade, guess, score from 1 to 5. Here in AP seminar, we have performance tasks. So I think it's 65% or so of your grade has already been decided before you go into May based on these collaborative and research-oriented assignments. This is the beginning of part 2, where students have to take 7 stimulus texts that have been provided by College Board and find ways to make thematic connections between at least 2 of them. This was their third reading, I want to say. So the goal of this discussion was how do we understand the text itself, but also how do we connect it to things that have been discussed in previous readings, right? So that's where you saw there was a lot of moments where they were talking about the false nostalgia article or, you know, the charts that were at the end of the packet. I think I gave you a packet, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So you guys, so there, it really was an opportunity for them to make of it what they would, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And each class came up with some very different responses. And I think that's one of the really hard things about Harkness is letting go and letting those conversations take their different courses, right? Sometimes as a teacher, I really like the way that one class went and then the second class goes, not in a bad direction, but just very different than what I would have gone. And I just have to, you know, remember that it's about student-driven learning. And usually by the time it all comes together, it comes full circle and they've hit most of those topics. And I think that's probably the most frustrating thing for a teacher is sitting there and waiting for the excellence to happen and not stepping in and navigating the conversation too early.
Yeah, I think that, you know, as I learn more about Harkness, one thing that I'm noticing, it is really all about people's past lived experiences. And they bring those past lived experiences into the conversation and interpret the text differently. Mm-hmm. And each conversation goes differently because there's different people in the room at different times and all bringing their own experiences in. You know, one of the things that you had mentioned about waiting for those topics to kind of mature and come to the conversation more authentically, I think, rather than having it contrived from the teacher. And that's a hard skill to develop. It's like think time, right? Like you have a limited time in your classroom. You ask a question and kids need to think about it. And it's hard to like give them the think time because you know that you have a scope and sequence to hold on to and you have to get to the next topic. But I think having that opportunity not only to provide that think time for kids brings the autonomy in, right, for themselves to have that curiosity and wonder build, but also to have the conversation spiral in a way that is meaningful and brings everybody's personal experience into the conversation. And it might not get to the concept where you might think it fits, but it will come in different times. And that's when I think learners make the most meaning from it, is when you allow that time that brings the conversation together in the classroom.
Absolutely. And I think the coolest thing that I've seen is when the conversation goes somewhere I didn't expect, because a student does have a personal connection, right? I have a, you know, cultural connection. Students have brought up past, you know, their ancestors or familial lines and how it relates to it. So sometimes what you get out of it is so much more just because I wasn't even on that same page. And now, wow, that student brought this to my attention. Yes, that does connect. So it's exciting when that does happen. And you don't have that opportunity if you don't let the students really process and speak on their behalf.
And it becomes a learning experience for you, I think, as mm-hmm. well, right? I mean, I sat in that conversation too. And when people, when students bring their own experiences in, you get to know them as people and students, right? And you're Absolutely. Like, oh, I never knew that about you, or I never knew that about your family or that experience you had. And I think that builds more community in the classroom too. And when the community builds and the trust builds, I think that the conversation becomes a bit more sophisticated yes. when you get to know one another more and understand each other's backgrounds.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So after the discussion, you had showed me two maps from previous Harkness discussions you've had, and one showed a conversation that was passed around the table, yet continually came back to just a few vocal students, and the other one that was more evenly distributed around the table. So what strategies do you use to help your classes move from a discussion dominated by just a few voices to one where everybody feels comfortable contributing?
Yeah, so that's a hard thing for students. Speaking to Mr. Capoletti, who's someone who's been doing Harkness for years, when I came into kind of doing it myself, the hardest thing is teaching is letting a student know that you're not the winner by speaking the most, right? We kind of train students that you need to do the most, speak the most, learn the most. And there's this almost sense of competition that starts off, especially at the beginning of the school year. I want to get my voice out as many times as possible, even without the grade. There's still a lot of students, myself included, when I was a student, who wants to do that. So the first thing is just having a conversation where students understand what you're trying to get out of it, right? I'm not looking for someone to be a superstar. I'm not looking for someone to monopolize a conversation. I'm looking for someone to balance it out. That's what a true Harkness student is. So right off the bat, just having that conversation, if you don't do that, then you're probably going to get a lot of those voices. As I've learned the times that I maybe forget to emphasize that. And all of a sudden, as you saw, there's some extra voices, some extra thoughts coming from individual people. The next is just recognition. So that's where the reflection really comes into play. Letting that conversation play out, I think, is important, unless it's egregious how much someone's speaking or they're starting to say things they shouldn't be saying. I usually don't step in. That's why you saw the chart as it was at the end, where there was a couple students with a lot of thoughts. But and unfortunately, you didn't get to see that conversation. They were the first to reflect and say, yeah, we talk a lot. Maybe we should find ways to bring in some people. I think it's also an opportunity for the people who don't get in a lot to ask them, why didn't you? So that's usually very eye-opening to students. Oh, I didn't feel like there was an opportunity today because people were talking really fast. Or I feel like we switched topics too much and I couldn't get my thought before we moved on. So it's a really good opportunity for them to say, here's how I would be able to interject more. And for the ones who are speaking a lot to say, oh, yeah, I recognize that's a problem. I've done a couple other things. I've switched seats a couple times. So like, hey, I know that this corner tends to be the one that talks a lot. Let's move people around. And it's been fascinating to see how the placement matters so much. Specifically, I've noticed the kids who are on the periphery of the talkative group tend to engage more. And then the further away you are, they don't. So if you put a talkative person next to someone who doesn't speak as much, they, by virtue of just sitting next to them, tend to be more willing to speak. I will say also, this is probably one of the things I interject the most on, which I try really hard not to interject, but I try to sometimes pause and say, okay, let's have a 2-minute conversation with the person next to you, or something that breaks up the conversation, allows someone who maybe was like, ah, this has got a little bit away from me, I don't know how to get in, a space to reflect and think and then hopefully speak. So there's like different strategies you can use there to try to bring other people in, but I do not try to put students on the spot if they don't want to speak that day.
Having those small conversations within that large one's a great strategy. I hadn't thought about that one, but just to bring students into a topic where, like you had said, it might gotten away from me because the conversation had gone for so long and I hadn't said anything. And just breaking that up to have that conversation with somebody else may just give that quieter student a spark of an idea. Or even, you know, one thing that I would say too, when I break up conversations into smaller groups and bring it back, just to say, would you share something that you had thought of or something that your partner had shared? Because it doesn't necessarily have to be your own idea at that point, right? You just want to have space for that student's voice and to have that opportunity to say, oh yeah, my partner shared a really great point, but I want to share it with the class, is a great way to invite students into that conversation as well. or just, you know, some of the more quieter students, like you had said, it's not about the quantity of your share, but the quality of your share. Mm-hmm. Even if it's a quieter student and, you know, they're on the peripheral engagement, just if they ask a question that guides the conversation into a new territory, I think that is worth way more than if you were to have a 15-minute, you know, monologue about an idea that you had had, right? And just to kind of push that conversation's thoughts further.
Yeah, that's usually like my first suggestion. Sometimes I have students who, you know, express that they don't feel like they can get in on the conversation, or they feel really uncomfortable. They don't feel like they know as much or whatever it may be. And my first thing, I'm like, well, ask a question, right? You don't have to be the one that comes up with this, like, you know, amazing solution to a problem, although I do think you're fully capable of doing so. And that gives opportunities. There are some students who usually warm up that way, right? So someone who's not as talkative will often be the one who starts the conversation, so they can get their thoughts out. They can ask a question. They can get engaged, and then they'll bring things in later. But I do also try to recognize the ones who don't speak as much and then do say something. I don't try to, like, make it seem like it's, you know, you did good and everyone else did not. But, hey, did you guys notice that, you know, when this student came in, that really changed the dynamic of conversation because they brought in this really cool connection to a text or something. So, and that always happens later. I don't do that in the moment.
Yeah. We had talked a lot about not only the conversation, but I think the reflective part of a Harkness discussion too. And as I continued to build my understanding of mind, brain, and education strategies that guide our planning and teaching at Detroit Country Day, I wonder, you know, what are those processes that you take to incorporate metacognitive reflection to help students assess their own contributions, recognize discussion patterns, and improve the way they engage in Harkness discussions? You had talked a bit about that, but I'd love to dive a little bit more into it.
Yeah, MBA is awesome. And what's really cool about it is it's a lot of stuff we're already doing, right? So it's sometimes hard to label like a certain strategy or something, because I think that as a school, we really just in our PD and just the way that our, like, my colleagues have just embraced teaching, a lot of times we're doing MBA without even realizing it. The reflection is probably the biggest piece. The fact that a lot of what they determine they got out of the conversation is what they generate, right? So it's not like I give a score or a grade. It's how they felt it went. And there's some times where I think a conversation went a certain way and they will completely, you know, 180 on me and say, no, it was bad, or oh, no, it was good, or, you know, they'll kind of give their own thoughts. And that's totally okay, too. The discussion patterns, I think, is the biggest thing that usually they pick up on, or if they don't, then I kind of like probe them for, that helps them really understand their own learning is, oh, I noticed that this has been happening, or they notice that this has been happening. It could be as simple as just a certain word choice that's being used. I know I mentioned the I think one, but again, like, that demonstrated to me, and it opened up a dialogue about why using the phrase I think weakens an argument, right? So they were able to see a pattern and then realize how they can move forward in more productive way of how they talk. Or a lot of times we look at body language. So students, if there's a stint where like students are getting really fast and the conversation's going really rapidly, you start noticing that when you want to talk, the other students are starting to lean in and they're trying to raise their hand or something. So acknowledging how those can be cues that maybe we need to, you know, slow it down for a second and give more space. As you were mentioning, the interleaving different skills throughout every discussion, right? They're not discussions in isolation. And I hang up every single discussion chart that we do so they can notice those trends. And I always pass them around too. So allowing them the ability to see, you know, what they're good at, what they could improve on, and continuously checking in on those hot spots throughout the year.
Yeah. And, you know, during the discussion, I heard learners connecting to their own prior understandings and use things that they learned in other content areas. And I specifically remember a learner saying, oh, this is something I learned in psychology class, as they continued their contribution. And the skill of interdisciplinary thinking or knowledge transfer helps students throughout their lives and into graduation and beyond. I'm wondering, you know, what other lasting skills might learners gain from engaging in Harkness discussions? And how do you see this approach preparing them for learning beyond high school?
Yeah, that's the coolest thing, because I don't get to sit in on those classes. And by giving students the opportunity to share their own thoughts, I learned so much from them, honestly. Especially, like, I think you were part of the conversation where they started talking about different celebrities. And I just don't know
yes,
that stuff.
Yes, I do remember
like,
that.
I was very intrigued. I'm like, wow, I need to do some more research myself on that. But it really just, it's about taking ownership of their own learning. it's not they're just, you know, memorizing material and then regurgitating it back. It is them now making connections and seeing the bigger picture. So viewing issues not in isolation, but in more of a broader sense, right? It's not just we're learning a thing in history and then you're done and then you move on and you go to psychology class and you learn something in psychology. It's, oh, this is all actually interdisciplinary. This is all relevant to everything in a sense, right?
So, sure. And there are concepts like, you know, cause and effect.
Yeah.
Right? That happens in all content areas. And thinking about, you know, how might something have, you know, had a big effect and what the cause was through the context provided by the College Board or in the psychology class or in their math class or, you know, wherever they are having things like that. What's the concept of the hippo and the tick bird, how they rely on one another to survive?
Symbiotic
relationships, right? So you think about like the symbiosis of, you know, different concepts that we have here, like one can't survive without the other, right? And thinking about those bigger concepts and how you can apply those into a Harkness discussion or how you can apply those into, you know, whatever context you have beyond school. I think having a opportunity to have discourse around it and use those skills, I think is really beneficial.
Yeah, and it's real life. There's very few things you can do in life where you can look at one thing from one perspective in one isolated chamber and not take everything else into consideration. So it's helping them kind of learn how to process their own understanding of the world.
Yeah. So for those of us that are listening and want to take their next step in running a Harkness-style discussion in their classroom, what advice would you give to those teachers?
Yeah, once again, I wouldn't consider myself an expert. You know, teaching is the one career where you're never a master of it, right? And Harkness is certainly the same way. I guess the first thing I would say is that you need to like let things, I think the word you used when we were discussing it in my classroom was let it bloom, right? You need to give Harkness time. If you just try it out for one class and you're like, ah, that didn't go well, moving on, new strategy, you won't be able to see the fruits of your labor in that sense. So giving it time and understanding that it's going to be messy, those first couple conversations, you're gonna be, you know, fighting to want to, you know, interject or to stop it or say, that's not what we're doing, right? But just letting it take its course through, you know, very careful selection of texts and things in advance, not saying come unprepared, but allowing those mistakes be made in the classroom because it's through the mistakes that the students are learning. Yeah, and just don't give up on it right away. If something doesn't work, reflect on that, have the students reflect on it, move on.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're creating a culture, a Harkness culture in the classroom, right? And a culture takes time. Having that time, not only in the actual, the minutes you spend around the Harkness table, but all of the prep time, all of the reflective time, all of the coaching time, all of the preparation time that the students take to make sure that they're active participants in the Harkness builds that culture that like you are an active participant in our classroom. Your ideas matter. And the questions you ask and the ways that you answer those questions guide the conversation. They know that Ms. Nessbaum's not going to interject. They know that because that's a part of Harkness. So if they want a successful conversation, they're going to have to be those contributors. And then they're compelled to do their homework. They're compelled to do the reading. They're compelled to share in the classroom. And I think that's a culture that's built.
And what's really cool is it's happening all across every disciplinary in the school right now. So I've had students, my sophomores come in, oh, we're doing Harkness today. Oh, yeah, just like we did in biology last week, right? So it's happening in more and more spots in their lives. So they're just getting more and more comfortable with it as a concept, which is great. It kind of takes a little bit of the work off of me in a sense because now they're getting even more perspectives, more reflection, and they're honing those skills even outside my classroom.
That's awesome. So time flies when you're having fun. It's time to wrap up and reflect. This is a question that I ask all the guests who are on Making School Matter, and I'm looking forward to your response as well. In the context of teaching and learning, would you please complete the sentence, I used to think and now I think?
So for this question, I actually went back to when I went to training this summer at Phillips Exeter. I had a very similar kind of statement I had to make going into it. So I looked back to what I thought about before I even started Harkness, and there was two really interesting things that I had misconceptions on. One is that I thought that Harkness would really only work with upperclassmen. I was like, oh yeah, that sounds great for an AP level junior, senior class, but there's no way my freshmen can do it, right? There's no way it can happen in middle school, right? So there's this misconception that you have to have classes of really experienced, wanting to learn students. And that is not necessarily the case. I've done several discussions with my freshmen, and they are some of the best conversations I've had, right? Everyone's capable of Harkness as long as you do the prep work. Obviously, if you throw a bunch of 14-year-olds into a conversation blind, yeah, it's going to be a train wreck. But if you do those same processes, you set them for success, you are really thoughtful about how you construct whatever text or things that they're going to be discussing, and you give them space to pause and have those moments of reflection, then it's possible for everyone. The second thing was that I didn't think that there was room for Harkness in actual content learning. So there was a thought of, oh, yeah, Harkness is great for when we're having, you know, like a political discussion, but it can't be used for when I'm actually trying to, like, grind through some of that content. And that's also been proven false. It takes a little bit more work on your part. And that's where I say, like, Harkness is not easy for the teacher, right? So obviously, if you don't have a lot of, you know, good guiding text or evidence or things for students to pull from, then yeah, it's not going to be as productive for the content side of things. But students are really, you know, once again, they really like this style of learning. And because of that, they really buy in and do, you know, do follow through and get the objectives they need to get through. And usually the content just naturally kind of comes with that. So I guess those were my two biggest misconceptions and my two biggest worries going into kind of just throwing myself into Harkness this year that pleasantly have been dispelled.
That's wonderful. And I've, you know, thoroughly enjoyed my time in your classroom, just being a listening participant of the Harkness discussions. And the last time I was in, I even felt compelled to share a little bit of my perspective too. I know the teachers aren't supposed to do that, but I wasn't the leader of the Harkness. I was just a contributor. So thank you for providing me that opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime.
On behalf of everybody at Detroit Country Day School, thank you for listening to the Making School Matter podcast powered by the studios at DCDS. If you enjoyed our time together, please like, share, and subscribe. For more episodes, you can find us on all the popular podcast sites. For more information on Mind, Brain, and Education, or learning about the Detroit Country Day School, please visit dcds.edu. Until next time, I'm your host, Mike Medvinsky, and I encourage you to look closely, think deeply, and wonder incessantly.